important. Peer interactions teach social competence, context-dependent behavior, when to be friend or foe, where you fit in hierarchies. Young organisms utilize the greatest teaching tool ever to acquire such information, play. What is social play in the young? Writ large, it's an array of behaviors that train individuals in social competence. Writ medium, it's fragments of the real thing, bits and pieces of fixed action patterns, a chance to safely try out roles and improve motor skills. Writ small and endocrine, it's a demonstration that moderate and transient stress, stimulation, is great. Writ small and neurobiological, it's a tool for deciding which excess synapses to prune. The historian Johann Herzinger characterized humans as Homo ludens, man the player, with our structured, rule-bound play, i.e. games. Nevertheless, play is universal among socially complex species, ubiquitous among the young, and peaking at puberty, and all play involves similar behaviors, after some ethological translating. E.g., a dominant dog signals the benevolence needed to initiate play by crouching, diminishing herself. Translated into baboon, a dominant kid presents her rear to someone lower ranking. Play is vital. In order to play, animals forego foraging, expend calories, make themselves distracted and conspicuous to predators. Young organisms squander energy on play during famines. A child deprived of or disinterested in play rarely has a socially fulfilling adult life. Most of all, play is intrinsically pleasurable. Why else perform a smidgen of a behavioral sequence in an irrelevant setting? Dopaminergic pathways activate during play. Juvenile rats, when playing, emit the same vocalizations as when rewarded with food. Dogs spend half their calories wagging their tails to pheromonally announce their presence and availability for play. As emphasized by the psychiatrist Stuart Brown, founder of the National Institute for Play, the opposite of play is not work, it's depression. A challenge is to understand how the brain codes for the reinforcing properties of the variety of play. After all, play encompasses everything from mathematicians besting each other with hilarious calculus jokes to kids besting each other by making hilarious fart sounds with their armpits. One significant type of play involves fragments of aggression, what Harlow called rough and tumble play, kids wrestling, adolescent impalas butting heads, puppies play biting each other. Males typically do it more than females, and as we'll see soon, it's boosted by prenatal testosterone. Is rough-and-tumble play practice for life's looming status tournament, or are you already in the arena? A mixture of both. Expanding beyond peers, neighborhoods readily communicate culture to kids. Is there garbage everywhere? Are houses decrepit? What's ubiquitous? Bars, churches, libraries, or gun shops? Are there many parks, and are they safe to enter? Do billboards, ads, and bumper stickers sell religious or material paradises, celebrate acts of martyrdom, or kindness and inclusiveness? And then we get to culture at the level of tribes, nations, and states. Here, briefly, are some of the broadest cultural differences in child-rearing practices. Collectivist versus individualist cultures. As will be seen in Chapter 9, this is the most studied cultural contrast, typically comparing collectivist East Asian cultures with the uber-individualist America. Collectivist cultures emphasize interdependence, harmony, fitting in, the needs and responsibilities of the group. In contrast, individualist cultures value independence, competition, the needs and rights of the individual. On average, mothers in individualist cultures, when compared with those in collectivist ones, speak louder, play music louder, have more animated expressions. They view themselves as teachers rather than protectors, abhor a bored child, value high-energy affect. Their games emphasize individual competition, urge hobbies involving doing rather than observing, Kids are trained in verbal assertiveness to be autonomous and influential. Show a cartoon of a school of fish with one out front, and she'll describe it to her child as the leader. Mothers in collectivist cultures, in contrast, spend more time than individualist mothers soothing their child, maintaining contact, and facilitating contact with other adults. They value low arousal affect and sleep with their child to a later age. Games are about cooperation and fitting in. If playing with her child with, say, a toy car, the point is not exploring what a car does, i.e., being automobile, but the process of sharing. Thank you for giving me your car. Now I'll give it back to you. Kids are trained to get along, think of others, accept and adapt, rather than change situations. Morality and conformity are nearly synonymous. Show the cartoon of the school of fish, and the fish out front must have done something wrong, because no one will play with him. Logically, kids in individualist cultures acquire TOM later than collectivist culture kids, and activate pertinent circuits more to achieve the same degree of competence. For a collectivist child, social competence is all about taking someone else's perspective. Interestingly, kids in collectivist Japan play more violent video games than do American kids, yet are less aggressive. Moreover, exposing Japanese kids to media violence boosts aggression less than in American kids. Why the difference? Three possible contributing factors. A. American kids play alone more often, a lone wolf breeding ground. B. Japanese kids rarely have a computer or TV in their bedroom, so they play near their parents. C. Japanese video game violence is more likely to have pro-social collectivist themes. More in Chapter 9 on collectivist versus individualist cultures. Cultures of honor. These cultures emphasize rules of civility, courtesy, and hospitality. Taking retribution is expected for affronts to the honor of oneself, family, or clan. Failing to do so is shameful. These are cultures filled with vendettas, revenge, and honor killings. Cheeks aren't turned. A classic culture of honor is the American South, but as we'll see in Chapter 9, such cultures occur worldwide and with certain ecological correlates. A particularly lethal combo is when a culture of victimization, we were wronged last week, last decade, last millennium, is coupled with a culture of honor's ethos of retribution. Parenting in cultures of honor tends to be authoritarian. Kids are aggressive, particularly following honor violations, and staunchly endorse aggressive responses to scenarios of honor violation. Class differences. As noted, an infant baboon learns her place in the hierarchy from her mother. A human child's lesson about status are more complex. There is implicit cueing, subtle language cues, the cognitive and emotional weight of remembering the past. When your grandparents emigrated here, they couldn't even, and hoping about the future. When you grow up, you're going to... Baboon mothers teach their young appropriate behavioral context. Human parents teach their young what to bother dreaming about. Class differences in parenting in Western countries resemble parenting differences between Western countries and those in the developing world. In the West, a parent teaches and facilitates her child exploring the world. In the toughest corners of the developing world, little more is expected than the awesome task of keeping your child alive and buffered from the menacing world. Footnote. I've experienced a manifestation of such parenting in my decades of fieldwork in Kenya, where my nearest neighbors have been highly un-Westernized members of the Maasai tribe. Sometimes I'd run into someone I hadn't seen in a while who had had a baby in the interim, and it took me years to get out of my ridiculous Western reflex, "A new baby! That's wonderful! Mazel tov! What's her name?" Awkward silence. You don't give a baby a name, or perhaps aren't willing to utter it, until she survived her first malarial rainy season and hungry dry season. In Western cultures, class differences in parenting sort by Baumrind's typologies. In higher SES strata, parenting tends to be authoritative or permissive. In contrast, parenting in society's lower SES rungs is typically authoritarian, reflecting two themes. One concerns protecting. When are higher SES parents authoritarian? When there is danger. Sweetie, I love that you question things, but if you run into the street and I scream stop, you stop. A lower SES childhood is rife with threat. The other theme is preparing the child for the tough world out there. For the poor, adulthood consists of the socially dominant treating them in an authoritarian manner. Class differences in parenting were explored in a classic study by the anthropologist Audrey Cusero of St. Michael's College, who did fieldwork observing parents in three tribes: wealthy families on Manhattan's Upper East Side, a stable blue-collar community, and a poor, crime-ridden one, the last two both in Queens. The differences were fascinating. Parenting in the poor neighborhood involved hard defensive individualism. The neighborhood was rife with addiction, homelessness, incarceration, death, and parents' aim was to shelter their child from the literal and metaphorical street. Their speech was full of metaphors about not losing what was achieved, standing your ground, keeping up your pride, not letting others get under your skin. Parenting was authoritarian, toughening the goal. For example, parents teased kids far more than in the other neighborhoods. In contrast, working-class parenting involved hard, offensive individualism. Parents had some socioeconomic momentum, and kids were meant to maintain that precarious trajectory. Parents' speech about their hopes for their kids contained images of movement, progress, and athletics, getting ahead, testing the waters, going for the gold. With hard work and the impetus of generations of expectations, your child might pioneer landfall in the middle class. Parenting in both neighborhoods emphasized respect for authority, particularly within the family. Moreover, kids were fungible members of a category rather than individualized. You kids, get over here. Then there was the soft individualism of upper middle class parenting. Children's eventual success, by conventional standards, was a given, as were expectations of physical health. Far more vulnerable was a child's psychological health. When children could become anything, parents' responsibility was to facilitate their epic journey toward an individuated fulfillment. Moreover, the image of fulfillment was often post-conventional. I hope my child will never work an unsatisfying job just for money. This, after all, is a tribe giddied by tales of the shark in line to become CEO, chucking it to learn carpentry or oboe. Parent speech brimmed with metaphors of potential being fulfilled, flowering, blooming, growing, blossoming. Parenting was authoritative or permissive, riddled with ambivalence about parent-child power differentials. Rather than, you kids clean up this mess, there'd be the individuated, justifying request. Caitlin, Zach, Dakota, could you clean things up a bit, please? Malala is coming for dinner. Footnote. I once got a poignant reminder of just how permeating the consequences of lack of privilege are in my professional world. I was interviewing candidates for a position in my lab. In the process, I'd ask each person about how they handled interpersonal conflict, looking for people who promptly addressed a social tension rather than letting it fester into passive aggressiveness. I was interviewing a guy whose background was in Queens rather than the Upper East Side. And when asked, instead of giving the Upper East Side answer I hoped for, yeah, I know how bad things get when you don't communicate, I'd be pretty good at just asking the person to be considerate and please return my pipette when they borrow it, I got the correct answer from Queens. Nope, no problems there. I know that a lab is no place for fighting. You take it outside. You've got nothing to worry about with me. We've now seen how childhood events, from the first mother-infant interaction to the effects of culture, have persistent influences, and how biology mediates such influences. When combined with the preceding chapters, we have finished our tour of environmental effects on behavior, from the second before a behavior occurs to a second after birth. In effect, we've done environment. Time for next chapters, genes. But this ignores something crucial. Environment doesn't begin at birth. 9 long months. The cat in the hat in the womb. The existence of prenatal environmental influences caught the public's imagination with some charming studies demonstrating that near-term fetuses hear what's going on outside the womb, taste amniotic fluid, and remember and prefer those stimuli after birth. This was shown experimentally. Inject lemon-flavored saline into a pregnant rat's amniotic fluid, and her pups are born preferring that flavor. Moreover, some spices consumed by pregnant women get into amniotic fluid. Thus, we may be born preferring foods our mothers ate during pregnancy. Pretty unorthodox cultural transmission. Prenatal effects can also be auditory, as shown by inspired research by Anthony DeCasper of the University of North Carolina. A pregnant woman's voice is audible in the womb, and newborns recognize and prefer the sound of their mother's voice. DeCasper used Ethology's playbook to show this. A newborn can learn to suck a pacifier in 2 different patterns of long and short sucks. Generate one pattern, and you hear mom's voice. The other, another woman's voice. Newborns want mom's voice. Elements of language are also learned in utero. The contours of a newborn's cry are similar to the contours of speech in the mother's language. The cognitive capacities of near-term fetuses are even more remarkable. For example, fetuses can distinguish between 2 pairs of nonsense syllables. Beba versus Bobby. How do you know? Get this. Mom says beba, beba, beba repeatedly while fetal heart rate is monitored. Boring, or perhaps lulling, thinks the fetus, and heart rate slows. Then mom switches to Bobby. If the fetus doesn't distinguish between the two, heart rate deceleration continues. But if the difference is noted, whoa, what happened? Heart rate increases, which is what DeCasper reported. DeCasper and colleague Melanie Spence then showed, using the pacifier sucking pattern detection system, that newborns typically don't distinguish between the sounds of their mother reading a passage from The Cat in the Hat and from the rhythmically similar The King, the Mice, and the Cheese. But newborns whose mothers had read The Cat in the Hat out loud for hours during the last trimester preferred Dr. Seuss. Wow. Despite the charm of these findings, this book's concerns aren't rooted in such prenatal learning. Few infants are born with a preference for passages from, say, Mein Kampf. However, other prenatal environmental effects are quite consequential. Boy and girl brains, whatever that might mean. We start with a simple version of what environment means for a fetal brain. The nutrients, immune messengers, and most important, hormones carried to the brain in the fetal circulation. Once the pertinent glands have developed in a fetus, they are perfectly capable of secreting their characteristic hormones. This is particularly consequential. When hormones first made their entrance in Chapter 4, our discussion concerned their activational effects that lasted on the order of hours to days. In contrast, hormones in the fetus have organizational effects on the brain, causing lifelong changes in structure and function. Around 8 weeks post-conception, human fetal gonads start secreting their steroid hormones, testosterone in males, estrogen and progesterone in females. Crucially, testosterone plus anti-Müllerian hormone, also from the testes, masculinize the brain. 3 complications of increasing messiness. In many rodents, the brain isn't quite sexually differentiated at birth, and these hormonal effects continue postnatally. A messier complication. Surprisingly few testosterone effects in the brain result from the hormone binding to androgen receptors. Instead, testosterone enters target cells and, bizarrely, is converted to estrogen, then binds to intracellular estrogen receptors. While testosterone has its effects outside the brain, either as itself or after intracellular conversion to a related androgen, dihydrotestosterone. Thus, testosterone has much of its masculinizing effect in the brain by becoming estrogen. The conversion of testosterone to estrogen also occurs in the fetal brain. Wait, regardless of fetal sex, fetal circulation is full of maternal estrogen. Plus, female fetuses secrete estrogen. Thus, female fetal brains are bathed in estrogen. Why doesn't that masculinize the female fetal brain? Most likely, it's because fetuses make something called alpha-fetoprotein, which binds circulating estrogen, taking it out of action. So neither mom's estrogen nor fetal-derived estrogen masculinizes the brain in female fetuses. And it turns out that unless there is testosterone and anti-Müllerian hormone around, fetal mammalian brains automatically feminize. Now for the uber-messy complication. What exactly is a female or male brain? This is where the arguments begin. To start, male brains merely consistently drool reproductive hormones out of the hypothalamus, whereas female brains must master the cyclic secretion of ovulatory cycles. Thus, fetal life produces a hypothalamus that is more complexly wired in females. But how about sex differences in the behaviors that interest us? The question is, how much of male aggression is due to prenatal masculinizing of the brain? Virtually all of it, if we're talking rodents. Work in the 1950s by Robert Goy of the University of Wisconsin showed that in guinea pigs, an organizational effect of perinatal testosterone is to make the brain responsive to testosterone in adulthood. Near-term pregnant females would be treated with testosterone. This produced female offspring who, as adults, appeared normal, but were behaviorally masculinized. They were more sensitive than control females to an injection of testosterone, with a greater increase in aggression and male-typical sexual behavior, i.e., mounting other females. Moreover, estrogen was less effective at eliciting female-typical sexual behavior, i.e., a back-arching reflex called lordosis. Thus, prenatal testosterone exposure had masculinizing organizational effects, so that these females as adults responded to the activational effects of testosterone and estrogen as males would. This challenged dogma that sexual identity is due to social, not biological influences. This was the view of sociologists who hated high school biology, and of the medical establishment as well. According to this view, if an infant was born with sexually ambiguous genitalia, roughly 1-2% of births, it didn't matter which gender they were raised, as long as you decided within the first 18 months. Just do whichever reconstructive surgery was more convenient. So here's Goy, reporting that prenatal hormone environment, not social factors, determines adult sex-typical behaviors. But these are guinea pigs, was the retort. Goy and crew then studied non-human primates. A quick tour of sexually dimorphic, i.e. differing by sex, primate behavior. South American species, such as marmosets and tamarins, who form pair bonds, show few sex differences in behavior. In contrast, most Old World primates are highly dimorphic. Males are more aggressive, and females spend more time at affiliative behaviors, e.g. social grooming, interacting with infants. How's this for a sex difference? In one study, adult male rhesus monkeys were far more interested in playing with masculine human toys, e.g. wheeled toys, than feminine ones, stuffed animals, while females had a slight preference for feminine. What next? Female monkeys prefer young adult fantasy novels with female protagonists? Why should human toys be relevant to sex differences in monkeys? The authors speculate that this reflects the higher activity levels in males and how masculine toys facilitate more active play. Goy studied highly sexually dimorphic rhesus monkeys. There were already hints that testosterone has organizational effects on their behavior. Within weeks of birth, males are more active than females and spend more time in rough-and-tumble play. This is long before puberty and its burst of testosterone secretion. Furthermore, even if you suppress their testosterone levels at birth, low but nevertheless still higher than those of females, males still do more roughing and tumbling. This suggested that the sex difference arose from fetal hormone differences. Goy proved this by treating pregnant monkeys with testosterone and examining their female offspring. Testosterone exposure throughout pregnancy produced daughters who were pseudo-hermaphrodites, looked like males on the outside, but had female gonads on the inside. When compared with control females, these androgenized females did more rough-and-tumble play, were more aggressive, and displayed male-typical mounting behavior and vocalizations, as much as males by some measures. Importantly, most but not all behaviors were masculinized, and these androgenized females were as interested as control females in infants. Thus, testosterone has prenatal organizational effects on some but not all behaviors. In further studies, many carried out by Goy's student Kim Wallen of Emory University, pregnant females received lower doses of testosterone and only in the last trimester. This produced daughters with normal genitalia but masculinized behavior. The authors noted the relevance of this to transgender individuals, the external appearance of one sex, but the brain, if you will, of the other. Footnote. Remarkably, studies have examined brains of transgender individuals, concentrating on brain regions that, on the average, differ in size between men and women. And consistently, regardless of the desired direction of the sex change, and, in fact, regardless of whether the person had undergone a sex change yet, the dimorphic brain regions in transgender individuals resembled the sex of the person they had always felt themselves to be, not their actual sex. In other words, it's not the case that transgender individuals think they're a different gender than they actually are. It's more like they got stuck with the bodies of a different sex from who they actually are. And us. Initially, it seemed clear that prenatal testosterone exposure is also responsible for male aggression in humans. This was based on studies of a rare disorder, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, CAH. An enzyme in the adrenal glands has a mutation, and instead of making glucocorticoids, they make testosterone and other androgens, starting during fetal life. The lack of glucocorticoids causes serious metabolic problems requiring replacement hormones. And what about the excessive androgens in CAH girls who are typically born with ambiguous genitals and are infertile as adults? In the 1950s, psychologist John Money of Johns Hopkins University reported that CAH girls had pathologically high levels of male-typical behaviors, a paucity of female-typical ones, and elevated IQ. That sure stopped everyone in their tracks. But the research had some problems. First, the IQ finding was spurious. Parents willing to enroll their CAH child in these studies averaged higher levels of education than did controls. And the gender-typical behaviors? Normal was judged by 1950s Ozzie and Harriet standards. CAH girls were pathologically interested in having careers and disinterested in having babies. Oops, back to the drawing board. Careful contemporary CAH research has been conducted by Melissa Hines of the University of Cambridge. When compared with non-CAH girls, CAH girls do more rough-and-tumble play, fighting, and physical aggression. Moreover, they prefer masculine toys over dolls. As adults, they score lower on measures of tenderness and higher in aggressiveness, and self-report more aggression and less interest in infants. In addition, CAH women are more likely to be gay or bisexual or have a transgender sexual identity. Importantly, drug treatments begun soon after birth normalize androgen levels in these girls so that the excessive androgen exposure is solely prenatal. Thus, prenatal testosterone exposure appears to cause organizational changes that increase the incidence of male-typical behaviors. A similar conclusion is reached by an inverse of CAH, namely androgen insensitivity syndrome, AIS, historically called testicular feminization syndrome. A fetus is male, XY chromosomes, testes that secrete testosterone. But a mutation in the androgen receptor makes it insensitive to testosterone. Thus, the testes can secrete testosterone till the cows come home, but there won't be any masculinization. And often, the individual is born with a female external phenotype and is raised as a girl. Along comes puberty, she's not getting periods, and a trip to the doctor reveals that the girl is actually a boy, with testes typically near the stomach, plus a shortened vagina that dead ends. The individual usually continues with a female identity, but is infertile as an adult. In other words, when human males don't experience the organizational prenatal effects of testosterone, you get female typical behaviors and identification. Between CAH and AIS, the issue seems settled. Prenatal testosterone plays a major role in explaining sex differences in aggression and various affiliative pro-social behaviors in humans. Careful readers may have spotted two whopping big problems with this conclusion. Remember that CAH girls are born with a something's very different post-it, the ambiguous genitalia, typically requiring multiple reconstructive surgeries. CAH females are not merely prenatally androgenized. They're also raised by parents who know something is different, have slews of doctors mighty interested in their privates, and are treated with all sorts of hormones. It's impossible to attribute the behavioral profile solely to the prenatal androgens. Testosterone has no effects in AIS individuals because of the androgen receptor mutation. But doesn't testosterone have most of its fetal brain effects as estrogen, interacting with the estrogen receptor? That aspect of brain masculinization should have occurred despite the mutation. Complicating things, some of the masculinizing effects of prenatal testosterone in monkeys don't require conversion to estrogen. So we have genetically and gonadally male individuals with at least some brain masculinization raised successfully as females. The picture is complicated further. AIS individuals raised female have higher than expected rates of being gay and of having an other than female or neither female nor male sex slash gender self-identification. Arr, all we can say is that there is imperfect evidence that testosterone has masculinizing prenatal effects in humans as in other primates. The question becomes how big these effects are. Answering that question would be easy if you knew how much testosterone people were exposed to as fetuses. Which brings up a truly quirky finding, one likely to cause readers to start futzing awkwardly with a ruler. Weirdly, prenatal testosterone exposure influences digit length. Specifically, while the second finger is usually shorter than the fourth finger, the difference, the 2D to 4D ratio, is greater in men than in women, something first noted in the 1880s. The difference is demonstrable in third trimester fetuses, and the more fetal testosterone exposure, as assessed by amniocentesis, the more pronounced the ratio. Moreover, CAH females have a more masculine ratio, as do females who shared their fetal environment and thus some testosterone with a male twin, while AIS males have a more feminine ratio. The sex difference in the ratio occurs in other primates and rodents. And no one knows why this difference exists. Moreover, this oddity is not alone. A barely discernible background noise generated by the inner ear, otoacoustic emissions, shows a sex difference that reflects prenatal testosterone exposure. Go explain that. The 2D to 4D ratio is so variable, and the sex difference so small, that you can't determine someone's sex by knowing it. But it does tell you something about the extent of fetal testosterone exposure. So what does the extent of exposure, as assessed by the ratio, predict about adult behavior? Men with more masculine 2D to 4D ratios tend toward higher levels of aggression and math scores, more assertive personalities, higher rates of ADHD and autism, diseases with strong male biases, and decreased risk of depression and anxiety, disorders with a female skew. The faces and handwriting of such men are judged to be more masculine. Furthermore, some reports show a decreased likelihood of being gay. Women having a more feminine ratio have less chance of autism and more of anorexia, a female bias disease. They're less likely to be left-handed, a male skewed trait. Moreover, they exhibit less athletic ability and more attraction to highly masculine faces, and they're more likely to be straight, or, if lesbian, more likely to take stereotypical female sexual roles. This constitutes some of the strongest evidence that A. fetal androgen exposure has organizational effects on adult behavior in humans, as in other species, and B. that individual differences in the extent of such exposure predict individual differences in adult behavior. Prenatal endocrine environment is destiny. Well, not exactly. These effects are small and variable, producing a meaningful relationship only when considering large numbers of individuals. Do testosterone's organizational effects determine the quality and/or quantity of aggression? No. How about the organizational plus the activational effects? Not those either. Expanding the scope of environment. Thus, the fetal brain can be influenced by hormones secreted by the fetus. But in addition, the outside world alters a pregnant woman's physiology, which in turn affects the fetal brain. The most obvious version of this is how food ingested by a pregnant female influences what nutrients are delivered to the fetal circulation. At an extreme, maternal malnutrition broadly impairs fetal brain development. Moreover, pathogens acquired by the mother can be passed to the fetus. For example, the protozoan parasite Toxoplasma gondii can infect someone pregnant, typically after exposure to infected cat feces, and eventually reach the fetal nervous system, potentially wreaking serious havoc. And this is also the world of maternal substance abuse producing heroin and crack babies or fetal alcohol syndrome. Importantly, maternal stress impacts fetal development. There are indirect routes. For example, stressed people consume less healthy diets and consume more substances of abuse. More directly, stress alters maternal blood pressure and immune defenses, which impact a fetus. Most important, stressed mothers secrete glucocorticoids, which enter fetal circulation and basically have the same bad consequences as in stressed infants and children. Glucocorticoids accomplish this through organizational effects on fetal brain construction and decreasing levels of growth factors, numbers of neurons and synapses, and so on. Just as prenatal testosterone exposure generates an adult brain that is more sensitive to environmental triggers of aggression, excessive prenatal glucocorticoid exposure produces an adult brain more sensitive to environmental triggers of depression and anxiety. In addition, prenatal glucocorticoid exposure has effects that blend classical developmental biology with molecular biology. To appreciate this, here's a highly simplified version of the next chapter's focus on genes. A. Each gene specifies the production of a specific type of protein. B. A gene has to be activated for the protein to be produced and deactivated to stop producing it. Thus, genes come with on-off switches. C. Every cell in our bodies contains the same library of genes. D. During development, the pattern of which genes are activated determines which cells turn into nose, which into toes, and so on. E. Forever after, nose, toes, and other cells retain distinctive patterns of gene activation. Chapter 4 discussed how some hormones have activational effects by altering on-off switches on particular genes, e.g. testosterone-activating genes related to increased growth in muscle cells. The field of epigenetics concerns how some hormonal organizational effects arise from permanently turning particular genes on or off in particular cells. Plenty more on this in the next chapter. This helps explain why your toes and nose work differently. More important, epigenetic changes also occur in the brain. This domain of epigenetics was uncovered in a landmark 2004 study by Meany and colleagues, one of the most cited papers published in the prestigious journal Nature Neuroscience. They had shown previously that offspring of more attentive rat mothers, those that frequently nurse, groom, and lick their pups, become adults with lower glucocorticoid levels, less anxiety, better learning, and delayed brain aging. The paper showed that these changes were epigenetic, that mothering style altered the on-off switch in a gene relevant to the brain's stress response. Whoa, mothering style alters gene regulation in pups' brains. Remarkably, Meany, along with Darlene Francis of the University of California, Berkeley, then showed that such rat pups, as adults, are more attentive mothers, passing this trait epigenetically to the next generation. Thus, adult behavior produces persistent molecular brain changes in offspring, programming them to be likely to replicate that distinctive behavior in adulthood. More findings flooded in, many provided by Meany, his collaborator Moshe Scherf, also of McGill, and Francis Champagne of Columbia University. Hormonal responses to various fetal and childhood experiences have epigenetic effects on genes related to the growth factor BDNF, to the vasopressin and oxytocin system, and to estrogen sensitivity. These effects are pertinent to adult cognition, personality, emotionality, and psychiatric health. Childhood abuse, for example, causes epigenetic changes in hundreds of genes in the human hippocampus. Moreover, Stephen Suomi of the National Institutes of Health and Scherf found that mothering style in monkeys has epigenetic effects on more than 1,000 frontocortical genes. This is totally revolutionary. Sort of. Which segues to a chapter summary. Conclusions. Epigenetic environmental effects on the developing brain are hugely exciting. Nonetheless, curbing of enthusiasm is needed. Findings have been overinterpreted, and as more researchers flock to the subject, the quality of studies has declined. Moreover, there is the temptation to conclude that epigenetics explains everything, whatever that might be. Most effects of childhood experience on adult outcomes probably don't involve epigenetics, and, stay tuned, most epigenetic changes are transient. Particularly strong criticisms come from molecular geneticists rather than behavioral scientists, who generally embrace the topic. Some of the negativity from the former, I suspect, is fueled by the indignity of having to incorporate the likes of rat mothers licking their pups into their beautiful world of gene regulation. But the excitement should be restrained on a deeper level, one relevant to the entire chapter. Stimulating environments, harsh parents, good neighborhoods, uninspiring teachers, optimal diets, all alter genes in the brain. Wow. And not that long ago, the revolution was about how environment and experience change the excitability of synapses, their number, neuronal circuits, even the number of neurons. Whoa. And earlier, the revolution was about how environment and experience can change the sizes of different parts of the brain. Amazing. But none of this is truly amazing, because things must work these ways. While little in childhood determines an adult behavior, virtually everything in childhood changes propensities towards some adult behavior. Freud, Bowlby, Harlow, Meany, from their differing perspectives, all make the same fundamental and once revolutionary point. Childhood matters. All that the likes of growth factors, on-off switches, and rates of myelination do is provide insights into the innards of that fact. Such insight is plenty useful. It shows the steps linking childhood point A to adult point Z. It shows how parents can produce offspring whose behaviors resemble their own. It identifies Achilles' heels that explain how childhood adversity can make for damaged and damaging adults. And it hints at how bad outcomes might be reversed and good outcomes reinforced. There is another use. In Chapter 2, I recounted how it required the demonstration of hippocampal volume loss in combat vets with PTSD to finally convince many in power that the disorder is real. Similarly, it shouldn't require molecular genetics or neuroendocrinology factoids to prove that childhood matters, and thus that it profoundly matters to provide childhoods filled with good health and safety, love and nurturance, and opportunity. But insofar as it seems to require precisely that sort of scientific validation at times, more power to those factoids. Chapter 8. Back to when you were just a fertilized egg. I'm reminded of a cartoon where one lab-coated scientist is telling the other, You know how you're on the phone and the other person wants to get off but won't say it? So they say, well, you probably need to get going. Like you're the one who wants to get off when it's really them? I think I found the gene for that. This chapter is about progress in finding the gene for that. Our prototypical behavior has occurred. How was it influenced by events when the egg and sperm that formed that person joined, creating their genome, the chromosomes, the sequences of DNA, destined to be duplicated in every cell in that future person's body? What role did those genes play in causing that behavior? Genes are relevant to, say, aggression, which is why we're less alarmed if a toddler pulls at the ears of a basset hound rather than a pit bull. Genes are relevant to everything in this book. Many neurotransmitters and hormones are coded for by genes, as are molecules that construct or degrade those messengers, as are their receptors. Ditto for growth factors guiding brain plasticity. Genes typically come in different versions. We each consist of an individuated orchestration of the different versions of our approximately 20,000 genes. This topic carries two burdens. The first reflects many people being troubled by linking genes with behavior. In one incident from my academic youth, a federally funded conference was canceled for suggesting that genes were pertinent to violence. This suspicion of gene-behavior links exists because of the pseudoscientific genetics used to justify various isms, prejudice, and discrimination. Such pseudoscience has fostered racism and sexism, birthed eugenics and forced sterilizations, allowed scientifically meaningless versions of words like innate to justify the neglect of have-nots. And monstrous distortions of genetics have fueled those who lynch, ethnically cleanse, or march children into gas chambers. But studying the genetics of behavior also carries the opposite burden of people who are overly enthusiastic about the subject. After all, this is the genomics era, with personalized genomic medicine, people getting their genome sequenced, and popular writing about genomics giddy with terms like the Holy Grail and the Code of Codes. In a reductionist view, understanding something complex requires breaking it down into its components. Understand those parts, add them together, and you'll understand the big picture. And in this reductionist world, to understand cells, organs, bodies, and behavior, the best constituent part to study is genes. Overenthusiasm for genes can reflect a sense that people possess an immutable, distinctive essence, although essentialism predates genomics. Consider a study concerning moral spillover based on kinship. Suppose a person harmed people two generations ago. Are this person's grandchildren obliged to help his victim's grandchildren? Subjects viewed a biological grandchild as more obligated than one adopted into the family at birth. The biological relationship carried a taint. Moreover, subjects were more willing to jail two long-lost identical twins for a crime committed by one of them than to jail two unrelated but perfect lookalikes. The former, raised in different environments, share a moral taint because of their identical genes. People see essentialism embedded in bloodlines, i.e., genes. This chapter threads between these two extremes, concluding that while genes are important to this book's concerns, they're far less so than often thought. The chapter first introduces gene function and regulation, showing the limits of genes' power. Next, it examines genetic influences on behavior in general. Finally, we'll examine genetic influences on our best and worst behaviors. Part 1. Genes from the bottom up. We start by considering the limited power of genes. If you are shaky about topics such as the central dogma, DNA codes for RNA, which codes for protein sequence, protein structure determining function, the three nucleotide codon code, or the basics of point, insertion, and deletion mutations, see Appendix 3. Do genes know what they are doing? The triumph of the environment. So genes specify protein structure, shape, and function. And since proteins do virtually everything, this makes DNA the holy grail of life. But no, genes don't decide when a new protein is made. Dogma was that there'd be a stretch of DNA in a chromosome constituting a single gene, followed by a stop codon, followed immediately by the next gene, and then the next. But genes don't actually come one after another. Not all DNA constitutes genes. Instead, there are stretches of DNA between genes that are non-coding, that are not transcribed. Footnote. Terminology. A gene is transcribed when the RNA template of its DNA sequence is made, which is then used to generate the protein that it codes for. And now, a flabbergasting number. 95% of DNA is non-coding. 95%. What is that 95%? Some is junk, remnants of pseudogenes inactivated by evolution. But buried in that are the keys to the kingdom, the instruction manual for when to transcribe particular genes, the on-off switches for gene transcription. A gene doesn't decide when to be photocopied into RNA to generate its protein. Instead, before the start of the stretch of DNA coding for that gene is a short stretch called a promoter, the on switch. What turns the promoter switch on? Something called a transcription factor, TF, binds to the promoter. This causes the recruitment of enzymes that transcribe the gene into RNA. Meanwhile, other transcription factors deactivate genes. This is huge. Saying that a gene decides when it is transcribed is like saying that a recipe decides when a cake is baked. Thus, transcription factors regulate genes. What regulates transcription factors? The answer devastates the concept of genetic determinism. The environment. To start unexcitingly, environment can mean intracellular environment. Suppose a hard-working neuron is low on energy. This state activates a particular transcription factor, which binds to a specific promoter, which activates the next gene in line, the downstream gene. This gene codes for a glucose transporter. More glucose transporter proteins are made and inserted into the cell membrane, improving the neuron's ability to access circulating glucose. Next, consider environment, including the neuron next door, which releases serotonin onto the neuron in question. Suppose less serotonin has been released lately. Sentinel transcription factors in dendritic spines sense this, travel to the DNA, and bind to the promoter upstream of the serotonin receptor gene. More receptor is made and placed in the dendritic spines, and they become more sensitive to the faint serotonin signal. Sometimes environment can be far-flung within an organism. A male secretes testosterone, which travels through the bloodstream and binds to androgen receptors in muscle cells. This activates a transcription factor cascade that results in more intracellular scaffolding proteins, enlarging the cell, i.e., muscle mass increases. Finally, and most important, there is environment, meaning the outside world. A female smells her newborn, meaning that odorant molecules that floated off the baby bind to receptors in her nose. The receptors activate and, many steps later in the hypothalamus, a transcription factor activates, leading to the production of more oxytocin. Once secreted, the oxytocin causes milk letdown. Genes are not the deterministic holy grail if they can be regulated by the smell of a baby's tushy. Genes are regulated by all the incarnations of environment. In other words, genes don't make sense outside the context of environment. Promoters and transcription factor introduce if-then clauses. If you smell your baby, then activate the oxytocin gene. Now the plot thickens. There are multiple types of transcription factors in a cell, each binding to a particular DNA sequence constituting a particular promoter. Consider a genome containing one gene. In that imaginary organism, there is only a single profile of transcription, i.e., the gene is transcribed, requiring only one transcription factor. Now consider a genome consisting of genes A and B, meaning three different transcription profiles. A is transcribed, B is transcribed, A and B are transcribed. requiring three different TFs, assuming you activate only one at a time. Three genes, seven transcription profiles, A, B, C, A plus B, A plus C, B plus C, A plus B plus C, seven different TFs. Four genes, 15 profiles, five genes, 31 profiles. As the number of genes in a genome increases, the number of possible expression profiles increases exponentially, as does the number of TFs needed to produce those profiles. Now, another wrinkle that, in the lingo of an ancient generation, will blow your mind. TFs are usually proteins, coded for by genes. Back to genes A and B. To fully exploit them, you need the TF that activates gene A, and the TF that activates gene B, and the TF that activates genes A and B. Thus, there must exist three more genes, each coding for one of those TFs, requiring TFs that activate those genes, and TFs for the genes coding for those TFs. Whoa, genomes aren't infinite. Instead, TFs regulate one another's transcription, solving that pesky infinity problem. Importantly, across the species whose genomes have been sequenced, the longer the genome, i.e. roughly the more genes there are, the greater the percentage of genes coding for TFs. In other words, the more genomically complex the organism, the larger the percentage of the genome devoted to gene regulation by the environment. Back to mutations. Can there be mutations in DNA stretches constituting promoters? Yes, and more often than in genes themselves. In the 1970s, Alan Wilson and Mary Claire King at Berkeley correctly theorized that the evolution of genes is less important than the evolution of regulatory sequences upstream of genes, and thus how the environment regulates genes. Reflecting that, a disproportionate share of genetic differences between chimps and humans are in genes for TFs. Time for more complexity. Suppose you have genes 1 through 10 and transcription factors A, B, and C. TFA induces the transcription of genes 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9. TFB induces genes 1, 2, 5, and 6. TFC induces 1, 5, and 10. Thus, upstream of gene 1 are separate promoters responding to TFs A, B, and C. Thus, genes can be regulated by multiple TFs. Conversely, each TF usually activates more than one gene, meaning that multiple genes are typically activated in networks. For example, cell injury causes a TF called NFKB to activate a network of inflammation genes. Suppose the promoter upstream of gene 3 that responds to promoter TFA has a mutation making it responsive to TFB. Result? Gene 3 is now activated as part of a different network. Same network-wide outcome if there is a mutation in a gene for a TF, producing a protein that binds to a different promoter type. Consider this. The human genome codes for about 1,500 different TFs, contains 4 million TF binding sites, and the average cell uses about 200,000 such sites to generate its distinctive gene expression profile. This is boggling. Epigenetics. The last chapter introduced the phenomenon of environmental influences freezing genetic on-off in one position. Such epigenetic changes were relevant to events, particularly in childhood, causing persistent effects on the brain and behavior. For example, recall those pair-bonding prairie voles. When females and males first mate, there are epigenetic changes in regulation of oxytocin and vasopressin receptor genes in the nucleus accumbens, that target of mesolimbic dopamine projection. Let's translate the last chapter's imagery of freezing on-off switches into molecular biology. What mechanisms underlie epigenetic changes in gene regulation? An environmental input results in a chemical being attached tightly to a promoter or to some nearby structural proteins surrounding DNA. The result of either is that TFs can no longer access or properly bind to the promoter, thus silencing the gene. As emphasized in the last chapter, epigenetic changes can be multigenerational. Dogma was that all the epigenetic marks, i.e. changes in the DNA or surrounding proteins, were erased in eggs and sperm. But it turns out that epigenetic marks can be passed on by both, e.g. make male mice diabetic, and they pass the trait to their offspring via epigenetic changes in sperm. Recall one of the great punching bags of science history, the 18th century French biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. All anybody knows about the guy now is that he was wrong about heredity. Suppose a giraffe habitually stretches her neck to reach leaves high in a tree. This lengthens her neck. According to Lamarck, when she has babies, they will have longer necks because of acquired inheritance. Lunatic! Buffoon! Epigenetically mediated mechanisms of inheritance, now often called neo-Lamarckian inheritance, prove Lamarck right in this narrow domain. Centuries late, the guy's getting some acclaim. Thus, not only does environment regulate genes, but it can do so with effects that last days to lifetimes. The modular construction of genes, exons and introns. Time to do in another dogma about DNA. It turns out that most genes are not coded for by a continuous stretch of DNA. Instead, there might be a stretch of non-coding DNA in the middle. In that case, the two separate stretches of coding DNA are called exons, separated by an intron. Many genes are broken into numerous exons, with, logically, one less intron than the number of exons. How do you produce a protein from an exonic gene? The RNA photocopy of the gene initially contains the exons and introns. An enzyme removes the intronic parts and splices together the exons. Clunky, but with big implications. Back to each particular gene coding for a particular protein. Introns and exons destroy the simplicity. Imagine a gene consisting of exons 1, 2, and 3, separated by introns A and B. In one part of the body, a splicing enzyme exists that splices out the introns and also trashes exon 3, producing a protein coded for by exons 1 and 2. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the body, a different splicing enzyme jettisons exon 2 along with the introns, producing a protein derived from exons 1 and 3. In another cell type, a protein is made solely from exon 1. Thus, alternative splicing can generate multiple unique proteins from a single stretch of DNA. So much for one gene specifies one protein. This gene specifies seven. A, B, C, A, B, A, C, B, C, and A, B, C. Remarkably, 90% of human genes with exons are alternatively spliced. Moreover, when a gene is regulated by multiple TFs, each can direct the transcription of a different combination of exons. Oh, and splicing enzymes are proteins, meaning that each is coded for by a gene. Loops and loops. Transposable genetic elements, the stability of the genome, and neurogenesis. Time to unmoor another cherished idea, namely that genes inherited from your parents, i.e. what you started with as a fertilized egg, are immutable. This calls up a great chapter of science history. In the 1940s, an accomplished plant geneticist named Barbara McClintock observed something impossible. She was studying the inheritance of kernel color in maize, a frequent tool of geneticists, and found patterns of mutations unexplained by any known mechanism. The only possibility, she concluded, was that stretches of DNA had been copied, with the copy then randomly inserted into another stretch of DNA. Yeah, right. Clearly McClintock, with her derisively named jumping genes, had gone mad, and so she was ignored. Not exactly true, but this detracts from the drama. She soldiered on in epic isolation. And finally, with the molecular revolution of the 1970s, she was vindicated about her now-termed transposable genetic elements, or transposons. She was lionized, canonized, Nobel prized, and was wonderfully inspirational, as disinterested in acclaim as in her ostracism, working until her 90s. Transpositional events rarely produce great outcomes. Consider a hypothetical stretch of DNA coding for the fertilized egg is implanted in the U, underlined, teres. There has been a transpositional event where the underlined stretch of message was copied and randomly plunked down elsewhere. The fertilized egg, teres, is implanted in the uterus. Gibberish. But sometimes the fertilized egg is im underline planted in the uterus becomes the fertilized eggplant is implanted in the uterus. Now, that's not an everyday occurrence. Plants utilize transposons. Suppose there is a drought. Plants can't move to wetter pastures like animals can. Plant stress, such as drought, induces transpositions in particular cells, where the plant metaphorically